Zanro on Double J.
Well, I mean, the last time that we spoke was about 5 years ago when you released Carrie and Lowell, and that album was an incredibly personal document, of course. What was on your mind when you were thinking about the ideas for The Ascension this time around?
Well, yeah, I think I deliberately wanted to possess myself of the personal, and I wanted to shake off the kind of folk song, singer-songwriter idioms, and I didn't want to sing about myself anymore. I was so sick of myself. I knew that that was the direction I wanted to take, but I didn't really know what kind of music or what kind of, like, tone I wanted to take until the election happened in 2016, and the whole, like, political climate over here started to really change. And there was an unveiling of sorts of sort of a deeper social malady in the U.S. And I had this little folk song that I had written during Carrie and Lowell called America that I had shelved. And so I went back to that song, found it in my, you know, my hard drive, and decided I was going to try to use that song as the template for the next record. I mean, I don't think all of this was really consciously on my mind, but this is kind of how it haphazardly happened.
That little folk
song. Yeah, it was just a little folk song. It was like 3 minutes long, and it was mentioning like Flood. There was like Judas and Heat, and I was like, and you know that, and then the chorus, "Don't do me what you did to America." It all just was like, it all just kind of came out, and it was all very strange and almost kind of cynical and mean-spirited and a little like with these kind of religious evangelical overtones. It felt almost like sacrilegious, using sacrilegious language. All of it was very, I felt very uncomfortable in the like embodying the voice of that narrative 6 years ago when I wrote it.
Mm.
It didn't make any sense to me. It just kind of all came out. I wasn't really sure what it was about. And I honestly couldn't really get behind it. And it didn't have anything to do with the rest of the material for Carrie and Lowell, so I just put it away. You know, fast forward a few years, and all of a sudden it felt really prescient, and it felt relevant, and it felt like, and I also felt like I had the constitution finally to embody the voice of a song like that. So I just decided to embrace it and to use that song as a template for the rest of the record.
Is it love?
That song finishes the album, that little folk song that turned into a 12-minute epic. It was the first song that you released in this, announcing this new record, The Ascension. It was the first single, which is a bold choice. I love a 12-minute single. But when this came out as well, the notes around this record said that it was a call for personal transformation. Is that your transformation or your listeners' transformation, our transformation?
Oh, I think it's both. I think it's both. You know, Carrie and Lowell is dealing with such a harrowing personal crisis, and I was called upon to, you know, by myself to deal with this personal crisis alone. You know, I had to really get through it, and I suffered through it. And now I feel like what we're going through is a very, like, universal global crisis, and we all have to figure out how to get through it. So the transformation is personal, but I'm taking to task society and the world and the community and, you know, a modern, you know, kind of our kind of modern civilization I'm taking it all to task and asking us, I guess, ultimately that we need to figure out a way to reset everything and restructure everything and admit that there's like systemic diseases, you know, in our culture that need to be dealt with. So it felt like a tremendous relief for me to not be thinking about myself for the first time in a while. Even though I'm clearly the center of every song, and there's a first person pronoun all over the place, and it's my voice, but I feel like I'm not speaking to my own personal misery, but I'm speaking to a generalized social misery, you know, that we're all going through.
That should be the selling line of your record. It speaks to a generalized social misery. Strap in. Amazing. I want to get to that because there are songs on this record that feel like, you know, almost like a kind of, you know, slow jam love song, but they feel very public in their lyrics. But let's run through some of the songs that come in early on this record. The album begins, to me, with this sort of sense of urgency with Make Me an Offer I Cannot Refuse. And it's not just the music, but your pleading vocal. What were you sort of forecasting with beginning the record with that song?
I think in some ways the song is about giving God an ultimatum. It's like what do you have to say for yourself? You know, if you are the divine being that you say you are, and if you are the sort of creative force, the source, you know, of all living things according to some world religion, then what do you have to say for humanity, for your creation and its devastation? So, and I'm being a little bit like melodramatic, of course, and didactic and angry. But I felt like I needed to embody that perspective and to commit myself to the role. You know, all these songs are taking on personas. And for that song, it's about frustration and exasperation to my divine creator. It's really kind of hilarious and ridiculous, but also it's a moment of catharsis for me, and I felt like I needed to start the record with like an exclamation point.
Getting older, you're becoming more pragmatic or more direct in your songwriting?
Yes, this is clearly happening on this record.
Mm.
Yeah, and I don't know if this is something that's going to stick with me for a while or if it's just a phase, but, you know, this whole record is riddled with catchphrases and cliches and colloquialisms, and I did that intentionally. I guess I decided I didn't always need to come up with an original idea, that I could just appropriate an old one and try to make it my own, and try to utilize it in these conversations about humanity and the world and society. Who am I? And why am I here? And I think I've become a lot less precious about my work. You know, I used to think that there was some kind of the sacredness to it, and that I needed to be like a steward of it in a way, and take care of it, and to really be measured in how I constructed it and shared it. But as I get older, I'm realizing like not everybody is listening that carefully. And it's like sometimes the nuance is lost in the white noise of, you know, pop culture.
Mm.
So I think this record is really just invested in absolute directness. And I'm not mincing words, you know. Almost all the songs are making statements and commandments and even declaratives and imperatives. And, you know, I'm taking to task many different things. And I feel like the subject of the record, or the most important, like the listener is actually at the center of the material. Like, it's not really about me, but this is about you. And yeah, I'm complicit too, and I'm part of this narrative, and I'm part of society. But a lot of these songs are directed at the listener.
Well, there's a song towards the end of the record that speaks to that, I guess, you know, your your questioning of the creator that begins at the record. The title track comes in as the second last song. Lyrically, it feels like one of the most dense on the album, and it kind of feels like a confrontation and a release. And it also sounds like you're sort of questioning blind faith. There's a line in it: I shouldn't have looked for revelation. I shouldn't have resigned myself to this.
I shouldn't have looked for revelation. I should have resigned myself to this.
Has your faith kind of dimmed or shifted in recent times? Or has questioning it always been part of what your faith has been about?
Yeah, I mean, I always feel like my faith is unsettled by circumstances and by certain situations, and every season of life I'm sort of calling to question what I believe in and why. And I think that's part of the process. I think doubt is inherent in the practice of belief, and that you kind of have to live with both. And so, you know, it's like I have a practice that's very simple and based on, you know, Christian orthodoxy, and, you know, I like to go to church and sing songs and all that stuff every once in a while. But then there's moments where I'm just totally at a loss and feel like there is no sacred design to everything. And I start to lose faith and start to distrust the systems around me. And especially now more than ever, because all of those systems are failing us, I feel that I can't be certain of anything. And I think that's part of the natural journey of being a believer in anything. And it's still like you have to cross that bridge and trust in the engineering, even if you don't quite believe that it can hold your weight. And that's kind of how I've been moving about my world and how I've been kind of going in and out of my faith. I think a lot of the language on this record is borrowing from, like, the Bible and from, you know, there's a lot of sort of religious imagery and references and all that. And it is quite jaded, and it's sometimes a little bit sacrilegious. And I think some people will probably read that as, like, you know, lost my spiritual path. But that's not true at all. I actually think that I feel more confident in my faith now than ever, and that has enabled me to then make these remarks and think about these things and have the bandwidth and the wherewithal to really question them. And I think that's just part of the nature of belief anyway.
Spreads beyond faith as well. There's, you know, so much division is around this idea of siding with a binary choice, but so much of our world is grey area and needs to be questioned, and we lose that kind of nuance, I think, in these conversations, particularly in social media, but even beyond.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, social media has really like had a tremendous influence on how we communicate and how we perceive the world, and everything is reduced and everything is polarized. And I just think that that's not fair to, like, humanity, and it's not fair to the discussion. So it's really important now more than ever, I think, to make room for the entire spectrum of, like, there's such a diversity and a multiplicity of systems, of beliefs and institutions and of points of view, and just the whole thing. Like, we can't reduce at this moment. We can't categorize into, like, these easy, polarized segments of the opposite ends of the spectrum.
You're not someone who lives a public life at all. I mean, you post to your Tumblr, but otherwise there's not really any Sufjan Stevens social media. I actually went onto your Facebook and realized that it was literally 10 years ago to the day that you last posted on your official Facebook page. One of the songs on this record speaks to that obsession with a performative life, I guess. Was there something that triggered the writing of video games?
That has a lot to do with social media. I think I've always opted out of all that. Like, whatever that Facebook page is, it was never me. It was probably someone from his Medicity who was posting on my behalf, you know. So I've opted out from the beginning. And I think it's, for me, it's been just, it hasn't really been my calling, and I just don't think I have the constitution to participate in that way. Yeah, and I'm kind of over it, like, the self-aggrandizement of, like, popular culture, celebrity culture on social media. It's like, I feel like it's really unhealthy, and it fosters, like, self-absorption and self-promotion, and I feel like everyone is branding themselves, you know, and I think it's really, really dangerous because, like, you're kind of losing your, sacrificing your soul. And, you know, I don't want to do that. I don't want to feel like I'm supposed to do that, to promote myself. I don't really need to be selling my brand because I don't have a brand, you know, it's just me. And I think people need to be told, I think that the next generation knows. They haven't really drank that Kool-Aid just yet. Like, hopefully they won't. But I think people need to know it's not necessary. You don't have to participate in these systems because these systems are selling and commodifying human beings. You know, it's like you're reducing yourself to a transaction. And I just think that that's really dangerous.
Yeah, and usually not for a very high price either. It's interesting then that the video that you made for it features Jalila Harmon, and this is a teenager who just blew up TikTok with her renegade dance move. It went hugely viral. So you've got her doing this beautiful choreographed dance to a song that speaks to that performative life. Is that why you chose her to represent it, to kind of screw, to subvert the idea of the song?
Yeah, I feel like it's sort of like the punctuation at the end of the sentence, which is that I really wanted to empower her. I wanted her to feel empowered and to have total creative control over what she did and to own it, because she did that dance, but no one really gave her credit for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it blew up, but, like, she didn't really see anything from it. And I think in that realm, in the world of, like, TikTok and dance videos and memes and things going viral, you kind of lose sense of, like, authorship of anything. And you also lose sense of, like, why are we doing this and what's it all for? So I thought, you know, because it's all kind of frivolous and fun, and that's fine. Like, we all need a little bit of escapism, and it's really fun to watch kids do really cool dances. But for the video, I thought, what if we just gave her center stage and just, like, it would just, and just showcased her entirely, her entire song. And it's not to become a meme or not to become, you know, not to go viral, but just to show just how incredible she is and what she does, you know, and let her own it.
I don't want to be a Julius Caesar. I don't want it to go down that way. But in a way, you gotta follow the procedure. So go ahead and play your video game.
One of the things that you said about this song when it came out, accompanying the release of the single, was be yourself, keep it real, keep it moving. Do all the things with absolute purity, love and joy, and always do your best. And it has been 5 years since your last solo record, but between this album and your last, you've made a lot of work. You've been collaborating with others. You've composed for a ballet. You made a new age album with your stepdad, Lol. Are you always moving, always creating?
I hope so. I mean, I think there's moments where you want to sit still and listen and contemplate mortality and stuff like that. You know, you need to make space for that. And on the seventh day, you should rest. But I think it's important to constantly be engaged in a creative practice, and that practice should always be changing, and it should never stay the same. Because I'm terrified of spaces. I'm terrified of growing stagnant. I'm terrified of losing this sense of surprise discovery in my work and in my practice. So it's kind of why I really try to work within different communities and in different disciplines, because it really keeps me sharp and it helps me to avoid a kind of stasis and apathy that I think is kind of like one of my biggest nightmares. To wake up one day and feel like I have nothing left to say or do. That being said, like, too much activity is harmful. So, like, don't think that I'm always working all the time. I do take time to rest. I do take time to go on hikes and go running and do other things. And, you have to refuel. You can't expend yourself. I've learned in middle age how to pace myself and how to be a better steward of my time and energy and resources. And so that's been really important in how I navigate all these different disciplines and all these different collaborations. So I've learned how to work in moderation and not expend too much, and also to not care too much. That's been really helpful too. The less I care about my work, the better.
It's such a product of age, isn't it? You just let all the bullshit go. It's so freeing.
It's such a relief. I turned 45 in July, and I just feel so happy and healthy and at peace in my middle age.
You're not afraid to party on this record, though, Sofia. And one of my favourite darker moments is Ativan.
Ativan, yeah, Ativan.
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 It sort of travels into this pop kind of industrial dance world. You almost feel like, you know, it sounds like you're inside a machine. What can you tell me about that song?
Well, yeah, a lot of this music is built off of drum programming.
Mm.
And it's kind of unusual for me to start with a beat, but that's kind of what I did almost entirely for every song in the record. Like, video games started with the beat. Almost every song started with a beat. For me, it's like that the rhythm is the heart of the matter, and the rhythm communicates the kind of the character of the song. And so that song, it's like there's this sort of despairing, dreading undertone, and it's kind of like almost like a four on the floor kind of a thing, which is really unusual for me.
Mm.
Like a pulsing heartbeat, you know, and eventually kind of opens up in terms of like we're in the club or something. We're in like Detroit in the 80s or something. Yeah, that song is pretty hilarious. It really goes there. I kind of wanted to allow myself some space to broaden the emotional space on this record. I gave myself license here to indulge in sort of the ecstasy and the agony and the love and affection, despair, all these things, I think are kind of the emotional environments in which I'm giving myself license to embody them and to feel things within them and to kind of work through with them. And I honestly, like, obviously, like, Ativan is about, kind of serotonin reuptake inhibitor. I think it's like, or maybe it's related to that. It's lorazepam, which is what you take, it's like Xanax, what you take when you're having a panic attack.
Right.
I don't know. I guess I wanted the song to feel like a panic attack. I wanted to feel like you were in it.
What a way to set out to make a song. I want to make a song that feels like you're in a panic attack. You're welcome. I woke up in stereo, spent the day. I mean, you are exploring so many different sounds on this record, but also it feels very much like you. And you've got a great history of electronic music. In fact, from your very early recordings, it was something that we first heard from you. You're also someone who I know plays pretty much every instrument on most of your stuff. Like, are you playing everything on this record? Is this all you?
Yeah, most of it's me. I finished the record like late last year, and by the end of the year I had Bryce and the National and my friend Casey come and play some stuff on it, and my drummer James did some stuff remotely on it. But almost everything, yeah, it's played by me. I mean, it's not a lot of instrumentation. It's very basic. I just worked with a Dave Smith Tempest drum machine, and he's a synthesizer designer. He designed the Prophet 5 from the 70s and 80s. And I have a bunch of his Prophets, and that's pretty much what I use for everything. All the vocals and the strings and things that might sound real are actually from a sample keyboard that he designed. I wanted to limit the technology just so that I could not get distracted by other possibilities. It just felt like I needed to stay within this one sort of synthesized world.
Well, you've built a huge epic with that. I mentioned earlier that I wanted to talk to you about what seems like a kind of slow jam but is a lot bigger. Sugar is the song that I'm talking about. It begins with this sort of swirling long intro before you slip into this, sort of R&B pop approach in songwriting. I guess it kind of feels both very personal and very public. Was that your intention, that it was a pop love song about humanity's demise?
Yeah, I mean, I'm making this turn of phrase that I actually first heard when I was a kid from Evil Dead 3. And I think the main character, Ash, I think is his name, says it to the heroine and, like, he tips her over and, gives her a kiss or something. It's super campy and cheesy. And I wanted to borrow that and utilize that as a kind of like a meditation on seeking goodness and truth and purity. And I think I wanted Sugar to kind of represent not just like affection and love and hugs and kisses, but to like a deeper level of meaning, something true and substantial. That's kind of what I'm seeking in that song. And I think a lot of the love, there's like a few couple love songs on this record. They're all kind of about that. They're about seeking a love potion or a some kind of like just seeking something that's better and pure in the face of crisis.
There was something that stuck out that I was reading last night that you said, the poetry outlives the poet. What kind of legacy and story do you want the Ascension to leave? Too big a question?
I'm dead.
Sorry, what did you say?
Did you say after I'm dead? You're talking about my death?
Well, you're going to die someday. Everyone dies.
Well, I just want people to know that I tried my hardest. I did my best. So I don't think one should be too concerned about one's legacy. I mean, I'm going to be dead, but who cares?
Again, that pragmatism, that 45-year-old pragmatism is creeping into everything. I love it.
I mean, I just want people to consider their condition as not being unchangeable. And I also feel like the approach needs to come from the bottom up or from the inside out. And like, I think we're putting too much trust and too much emphasis on like celebrities and politics and politicians and sort of the exterior world, So I think for me, even though this record is dealing with all that, this crisis of civilization in a lot of ways, I guess for me, I think people should also think about like the spiritual sublimation of their consciousness. Like, what if your problems aren't natural or actual, but actually metaphysical? What if it's about changing your heart, and changing your soul and changing how you perceive things? Like, it could be really that simple. So really, I just kind of am trying to ask the questions like, why are we here and what is it all for?
Just small questions.
I'm trying my best.
We talked about that first song that you wrote, this first seed for the Ascension America, which turned into a 12-minute epic. And that song finishes this record. It feels very open-ended, like there's a sense of kind of impending dread in the music. But then there's a rise, you know, there is an ascension towards the end. So where to next? Because it feels so open-ended, the rest of this record, or the end of this record.
Well, you know, I don't know if I told you, but I moved out of New York last year, and I relocated upstate New York in the Catskills. And so what I've really been looking at and thinking about engaging with a lot lately has been the natural world. And for me, it's been a really good witness to something that is working and that is successful and that has fidelity. And I feel like maybe the end of that record is pointing towards that. That, like, we can't ascend our problems, and we have all the tools to help us do that. But we also have the evidence, clear evidence that's in the world around us, that there's beauty, and there's hope, and there's balance, and there's sustainability in the natural world that I think we need to really look at. We need to look at what's working if we're going to move on.
I think, yeah, people keep on talking about, you know, nature is healing, nature is returning during these times of COVID. You sort of hope that, obviously, we can't live this way in this kind of lockdown for a substantial period of time, but you hope that people are turning to, you know, being reminded of the way that nature does continue to operate and goes on and figures it out and take those lessons into returning to this, you know, industrial world that we live in.
Yeah. And let's remind ourselves that we're part of that system. We're part of nature, you know, and so we have a role in it, even though we've extracted ourselves and think that we've overcome it. And we've created this, like, industrial technological world around us that can sustain us. We're actually still organic matter.
Yeah.
You know? And we're participating in the natural world, whether we love it or not. So let's be good stewards and do the best that we can.
You're with Zan Rowe on Double J.